Good afternoon, and welcome to today's audio conference training on accounting for the complexities of life and social standing. This audio training is offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Lucy Pope, and I'll be the host for today's call. Before we begin this training session, I'd like to just go over a couple details. First, this training is being recorded, and the audio recording will be available at praxisinternational.org. In order to eliminate background noise, all the lines will be muted throughout the call. We will be stopping for questions at 3 points during the call, so there's 2 ways that you can ask any questions or ask clarification. You can press the number 1 on your phone pad to be placed in a queue, and the operator will bring you into the call. And or you can email your question at any time during the call to denise@praxisinternational.org. The presenters today will be referencing the logistics guide for coordinators. For those of you who have that in front of you, they'll be focusing on Section 3. It's absolutely okay if you don't have that material in front of you, but if you want to look at it, let me walk you through how to download it. The guide is on the Praxis website at www.praxisinternational.org. Go to Our Programs, then the Institutional Analysis / Community Assessment tab on the left, and finally a tab labeled Resources. Then you should see the Guide for Coordinators and find Section 3. So you can, you know, you're welcome to access that at any time. We have two trainers today, Jane Sadusky and Alex Wilson. Many of you know Jane Sadusky from Madison, Wisconsin. She's worked in the battered women's movement for over 30 years. She's a longtime Praxis technical assistance partner, and she's worked with many community assessments and safety audit teams over the past 12 years. She's also co-authored a number of publications that you see if you've been doing this work. We're also so glad to have Alex Wilson join us today. Alex is on faculty in the College of Education at the University of Saskatchewan. She's Swampy Cree from the Apeskwayek Cree Nation and is involved in a number of projects, including developing a method for assessing violence and safety in schools, gay, lesbian, and two-spirit narratives from Northern Canada, the criminal and civil justice system's response to Native American women who have experienced domestic violence, and the work with the Aboriginal Educational Research Center. So thank you all for joining us today, and I'll turn it over to Jane to get us started.
Thank you, Lucy, and welcome everyone to our conversation this afternoon. When we were preparing for this, I was thinking about the title, Accounting for the Complexities of Life and Social Standing, and thinking, oh my, that is so huge. And it's a key issue in our criminal legal systems and other institutions. So we've taken a very big framework here, and we're going to really kind of center on one particular way of trying to improve the ways that we do this accounting really for people's lived experiences and acknowledging that we all come with our unique selves and identities and history and those differences that we have that make us distinct and unique, our differences in race, culture, class, gender, sexual orientation, frame our experience and oftentimes really frame the options that are available to us when we interact with institutions that are organized in certain ways. So we're going to be talking about this in the context of the community assessment work that many of you are familiar with and have launched in your own communities. And part of that goal in looking at how are things put together in ways that either meet people's needs or sometimes open very big gaps between what people need and what different systems and institutions provide. Part of the goal is doing that in ways that really does account for people's lives and lived experience. And again, these are very big questions that are at the center of much of the discussion and struggle in our communities in different ways. And how we begin is part of it's talking, it's reading, it's listening. One of the things that I kept coming back to and thinking of was this amazing interview that I heard in the last couple of years through was by a journalist, Bill Moyers. And you can find it online, and we can certainly follow up with this and send a link to folks. But it was an interview with Michelle Alexander, who's a thinker and writer who's really looking at issues of race disparity in the criminal legal system, and Brian Stevenson, who does a similar kind of work with the Equal Justice Initiative. And it was this kind of example of, if we're doing work in our communities addressing violence against women, trying to understand the broadest scope of women's lives, then part of that in accounting for complexity is really listening to and seeking out people like Michelle Alexander and Brian Stevenson and learning from them and following some of the intriguing questions that they raise about who and how and in what ways people get drawn up into the legal system, into the prisons, into the very complex systems that often don't meet people's complex lives very well. And then another example of this kind of talking, reading, and listening that I came across was a recent series of focus groups that were done actually nationally with, something I think like 250-some participants around the country. And it's an organization, the Center for Family Policy and Practice, which happens to be kind of across town from where I live here in Madison, Wisconsin. And they went out really seeking to talk with women, particularly African American women, about their community and safety and services. If they're living with battering and abuse, what would they like to see, and what's helpful and what's missing in their communities? And so it's another one of those ways in which we can help teach ourselves and learn about what might make a difference. So, for example, one of the things that...
Uh-oh, it looks like we did lose her. Okay, Jane has rejoined us.
Well, that was more drama than we needed this afternoon. And we'll hope that doesn't happen again. So I'm going to kind of move over there. I think the last comment that probably disappeared in somewhere into space there was just emphasizing learning from other sources and thinkers and the insight that we can gain from who's working on similar kinds of issues. We're going to talk mostly today about focus groups, which are one tool that we can use and use very readily to get a better understanding of, for example, what battered women's experiences are in our own communities. There are other tools that are available that we're not going to spend time on today, but I'll mention a couple of them. One is looking at setting up survivor or consumer advisory groups to a particular project, or a project such as a community assessment or policy writing. That might be a topic perhaps for another training. community forums, different ways, interviews, surveys. There's a lot of different avenues for expanding our knowledge, but we're particularly going to talk today about organizing, conducting, and using focus groups as a tool. And very briefly, focus groups are a particular kind of discussion. They're focused, they're planned, organized, facilitated, typically involving a relatively small number of people, maybe in the 7 to 10 range, who are invited to bring their perspective. Sometimes it might be a shared experience, so it might be inviting survivors to a group. It might be inviting a broader group of community members. And that interaction between people is kind of part of the process. It's a kind of a group interview, so there are questions that build on each other and help to expand our understanding. And it's a way to get information, really, about perceptions and views and experiences. It's a way to test out what we think we know about our policies and practices, and a way to kind of move a discussion from personal and individual experiences and insights into seeing how institutions and community systems are working and what kind of changes might need to take place. So it's a way of gathering information about what's happening. It's a way to hear from people who are sometimes underrepresented in official statistics or maybe overrepresented in official statistics. And it's a way of identifying themes across participants, across the community. So a tool that we can use, and we're going to dig in now to kind of what might go into organizing that.
Thank you, Jane.
I hope you're on the other end there, because your call cannot be completed message on an audio conference is a little disturbing.
We're all fine. But while you were gone, we did let folks know that if they wanted to ask a question or had needed any more clarification about what you were saying, to go ahead and press number 1 on your keypad or email to Denise. Either way, I'll give you just a second here.
Well, that's great. That's quick on our feet thinking.
We do have a question if you'd like to take it.
Thank you.
Okay, it comes from Kaw. Your line is open.
Okay, yes, I had a question. Do you have any focus groups that you've done that are available to others to view?
Are you thinking of the results, the reports that have come from it?
Uh-huh.
Yes, actually, there's quite a number of things, I think, between Alex and I that we could provide. And perhaps as a follow-up, we can organize that. I'll give you one example of a piece that I'm familiar with is a few years ago, Wisconsin did a statewide series of focus groups to really learn more about experiences of underrepresented and marginalized communities. And it involved recruiting facilitators from communities. There were probably out of that maybe about, I'm trying to remember, 20 different focus groups, looking specifically at experiences with domestic violence and sexual violence. So that's kind of an example of one thing that's out there. And then on the website, on the Praxis website, under this logistics guide that Lucy walked us through, there are several reports at the end there, all of which involved components of focus groups in gathering information. So they're not exactly focus group report backs per se, but they're built on that. And then the piece that I was referring to, the focus groups with women of color about safety and services, that'll be another one that we can connect you with, which is a very specific focus group report.
Okay, thank you very much.
And Alex, I'm going to move on over your direction. You may have something to add and can take it away.
Right, thanks. Thanks a lot, Jane. So another example is the Native Women's Research Project, and again, it's on that the same page. If you scroll down towards the bottom, there's a link to that report, and it says it's called the Community-Based Analysis of the U.S. Legal System's Intervention in Domestic Abuse Cases Involving Indigenous Women. And so that report documents our, the process that we used, and we used quite a number of focus groups with women and community members, and then also with practitioners. So that's a really good resource as well to see how focus groups are used. So I'm going to be talking about the logistics of organizing a focus group, and then from there we're going to be talking about actually conducting focus groups, and then what to do with the information, and then we'll talk about kind of reviewing tools and the logistics guide. So when organizing a focus group, I think one of the things to remember is this probably is the thing that's going to take the most amount of time in kind of the when you're thinking about and conducting focus groups. So you need a lot of lead time to set focus groups up. First of all, you need to decide how many you're going to have, you know, which people you're going to be inviting and that kind of thing. So I'm going to be referring to the sheet that's titled Planning Focus Groups with Battered Women. And again, there's a link there on the website. If you don't have the sheet, you can just kind of listen along. It's Planning Focus Groups with Battered Women, but some of the things will also apply to focus groups with practitioners. And so we've kind of focused on the planning with battered women because there are some things that we need to consider in particular with groups that are at risk, I guess you could say. So one of the first things in planning is thinking first and foremost about the safety of participants, of the women. And in doing that, there are considerations like what you will put on a flyer, what you will send out in an invitation letter. And the things that you need to think about are date, time, how long, compensation. You know, are they going to be compensated? Will food be provided? And will daycare be provided? But in terms of safety, the contact information is key. And how you're going to get the flyers out to people is also something to really take some time to think about. How will they contact you? And how will they maintain contact with you? Getting information about when it is, et cetera. Recruitment of participants also is something to consider in terms of safety. So this is really, this process can be really a reflection of how well the audit agency or the assessment agency or the organizer is connected within the community. So part of the process of organizing and conducting focus groups is maintaining or establishing and nurturing relationships within the community. And that needs to be recognized and also remembered throughout the entire process. So just to give an example of that, in the Native Women's Research Project, one of the ways that we attended to or thought about the safety of the participants in the group when we were thinking of who to invite was by talking to local elders and getting their involvement in the project. So now one of the things we had to think about in inviting community members to help us recruit was to know whether or not they had some kind of understanding around the issue of domestic violence. So we wanted people that had some understanding or some experience with it and who are going to understand issues around confidentiality, et cetera. Um, And another thing that we had to think about, again, is it safe to call people or is it safe to send a letter? And, you know, often people, women who are leaving situations especially, may not have access to a telephone or they may be moving around. And so very often getting somebody's phone number will not be a good way to contact people. And we found this in the Native Women's Project time and time again, where we had people who wanted to participate in focus groups and they would leave a contact phone number of a sister or somebody. And then, you know, when we were trying to contact them, they weren't there anymore. The phone was disconnected. So when you do connect with possible or potential participants, it's important to set up kind of a plan where they can either check in with you, drop by, or email you, or provide a number where it's agreed that you can leave information for them, you know, where it's going to be safe for you to say that, you know, there's a meeting at such and such a time, and, you know, that they'll know what you're talking about. In terms of recruitment, again, often one of the best ways for recruitment is word of mouth, and it's something also when you're thinking about planning and logistics, how that could lead to either a few people coming or a whole bunch of people coming. So either way, you've got to be prepared for that. And so, again, to give another example from the Native Women's Research Project, you know, word of mouth was probably the key way that we got participants from the community to come to the focus groups. And we were quite shocked the first time we went to have a focus group, because we were expecting 7 to 10 women, and that's how many had confirmed to us. And when we actually went to conduct the focus group in the community, we had way more, like almost 30 women show up. So word of mouth can really snowball, and especially when a community is typically marginalized and they don't often have the opportunity to share their stories, they may see this as a real opportunity to do that, and you know, there may be some excitement around it. So it's important to be prepared for that and to be prepared to maybe have another group at a future date if there's too many people for the space to accommodate or for your team to accommodate. And, you know, and just in relation to that, it is important to reach out to different culturally distinct communities. And, you know, the reason for that is because many marginalized communities, like people that are marginalized based on socioeconomic status or ethnicity or geographical location, often do not typically connect with mainstream organizations. And that's something we know in all institutions. So it's important to have that voice represented and to think about how to connect with that community. And again, often that is through relationships with organizations that typically serve that community, through individuals or advocates who are comfortable and knowledgeable with cultural protocols within the community. How many focus groups will we conduct? Well, that's a question that people always ask. Again, you have to look at the scope of your overall assessment and think about how much information you're going to need. And very often, you know, one focus group may be enough. Other times you may do a focus group and new questions will come up and you'll think, okay, we didn't think about this before, so, you know, we're going to refine our focus a little bit in the next group and bring in another group of women to look at that. So planning is important in terms of resources and having knowing the number of how many groups you're going to have. Compensation is key. You know, this notion of reciprocity is really important. There's a long history of researchers or community groups or government organizations taking, you know, and not bringing back things in return. And so this process is really grounded in or comes from the standpoint, a perspective of women who have been battered, and we really want to respect and acknowledge that. So one of the ways that people do that in this society is, you know, through the exchange of money. And so cash stipends are, you know, I guess part of what would be appropriate. And people often ask, well, how much of a stipend would you pay per person? And really that ranges, but you do need to budget for it ahead of time. The range is anywhere from $40 to up to $150. And I guess it depends on how much you have in your budget and how many groups you're going to have, that kind of thing. Also, in the lines of thinking about reciprocity and respect is transportation, being able to provide transportation for people to and from the focus group. And that could be taxi, in the form of taxi vouchers, reimbursement, bus tickets, or even rides. If you are providing rides, you do need to think about liability and those kinds of issues that may come up in terms of your insurance. And in terms of reimbursement, I think it's also important that often when people come, one of the reasons they may come is because there is a stipend available, and they usually expect it when they get there. And so it's important to try to have cash whenever possible and to put it in an envelope and to, you know, have a thank you note in there as well, as kind of another way to respect the participants. Child care is also really important, you know, especially when you're inviting women to a group. You can provide a stipend for that, or child care can be provided on site. It's important to think again about the space that you're going to be in, and whether there can be some separation between the kids and the women in the group. And we have had times when we've done focus groups and the kids are next door, and it's been kind of distracting because they'll, you know, try to run in and things like that, which in some cultures and some communities, it's kind of rude not to allow that, but in other communities, you know, it's okay to have the kids separate. So to have child care in the same building, you know, that would work, or to have people have, you know, a family member or a babysitter and then just reimburse them for their time. When you are providing, when you are thinking about the amount of time that a woman is going to take out of her day to help you out in your focus group, you need to think about the time it takes her to get to the focus group, the actual time in the group, which is, you know, usually about an hour and a half or so, and then time afterwards. So it's a big chunk of time that they're committing to you. So in terms of a stipend or an honorarium for them coming, you need to consider that, but you also need to consider the amount of time they're going to be away from their families. Food is another thing, and again, it's really important to think about the culture of the group or the community that you're working with. And so in working with women, battered women, if you have a focus group at dinner time, then it would make sense to provide a meal. And you have to also build that into the consideration for the amount of time the person's going to be there. So if your focus group is going to start at 5 o'clock, for example, and you plan to serve a meal, that'll take a lot of the time that you had planned for your group. So it's important to be really efficient, to start on time with your group and to move people through it quickly. If you're just going to serve munchies, one thing to remember is that it's a good idea not to serve crunchy snacks because they're really loud on the recordings. That's just something we've learned over the years. Let's see what else. Just to make sure that there's washrooms available and that it's accessible to all of your participants, so accessibility for any kind of disability, that you have resources such as flip charts, recorders, note takers available, and interpreters or transcription available later. So, you know, there may be people who are not English as first language speakers, or there may be people who speak multiple languages but think in a language other than English. So knowing your participants is really important to, you know whether you need to have an interpreter there. I think that's kind of time to kind of move on to the next area, but if there are any questions now, we could take those.
Thank you, Alex. Very, I love the detail, even down to the food. Excellent. Were there any questions? You just need to do the star, the number one on your keypad, and Carrie will connect you.
This is Jane. One comment I'll make while we're waiting to see if there are questions is, I've found that oftentimes connecting with community centers or libraries or a place that maybe has some adult program and children's programming where there's space already set up where there might be a play area for kids, thinking about where to do that is a big piece of organizing a successful focus group or series of focus groups. Most likely, trying to do them in a courthouse would not work very well unless you're doing focus groups with people who work in those systems. You know, we're mostly talking about community focus groups here, but that's another kind that can come into play as well if you're wanting to talk with a bunch of police officers or child protective services workers, depending on what you're doing.
Well, and Jane, this is Lucy. I would add that you need to perhaps think more creatively if you're in a very rural area where there might not be a library or a community center. So would you recommend then ever thinking about moving to another town down the road?
Well, that gets into all of those questions about transportation and getting people here. And part of it might be finding out, is there sort of a natural kind of congregation point? I'm thinking of some of the more rural focus group-related work that I've been involved in. And some of those actually were able to use a library or a church basement. And Alex, you might have some other ideas too for that more distinct kind setting.
That's possible, definitely, but it's important again to really think about safety. And you know, just to give an example of what happened one time with one of our focus groups is that because people, it's a small community on a reservation, people, you know, the word spread and everybody kind of knew. And so we were meeting in a space that was very public, even though we had private rooms within the space. But people were driving up and coming because they heard that there was something going on.
Oh.
And the guys didn't know what was going on, but at one point we had people, men actually walking and, like, staring in the window and kind of banging on the window. So, it's important to kind of think about those issues as well. So how are you going to make sure that there's some privacy around what's going on? Because in small communities, you know, everybody knows everyone's business. So, you know, to have it in the next community over might be a good idea, or to have it in a kind of a more discreet place as well.
Thank you.
And I'm thinking of another example in sitting in on some focus groups that were talking with Latinas about violence in their lives and kind of coordinating. In this case, it was the connection was through community-based social workers in the Department of Health and Family Services. And there the connection was through the public health agency. And it was really framed by, you know, again, it was this kind of word of mouth and very personal. Would you be interested in coming to talk about these issues? But we're going to call it something like women's health or, you know, children's, you know, mothering children. It there was a layer of safety kind of built around that in consultation with advocates from the community about what's the best way to do this. And then many of the women came with their partners and who waited outside for them. And we're very clear that we're not taking away any of the materials that are available, but we can come to this space. It's seen as a very, it's the kind of place that mothers come with their kids.
Thank you.
I think that this brings up another point, too, and that is to have resources available. So, you know, if you need to give somebody a phone number or anybody who needs help, or, you know, because people will always ask, you know, I have a friend in this situation, or, you know, so just to have those available or have an advocate there as well is helpful.
Thank you. Thank you. So we're ready to conduct now.
Right? Yeah, so no questions in the queue at this point, I take it?
There are no questions in the queue at this time.
All right, thank you. And I will certainly hope I don't get the message again that I've been disconnected. It's probably the squirrels. They get in the phone lines here a lot. So you've got people together, and they're eager to teach you about what you want to learn. And I'll probably keep using examples related to intimate partner violence and sexual violence, domestic violence, because that's what I'm really most familiar with, and I think it also relates to kind of a sense of who's on the line out there. But, you know, again, adapting this to whatever you're needing to learn about. And one of the questions to ask up front is who should do the facilitation? It might not be me as the organizer of the community assessment. Again, that's kind of getting that sense of who do we want to hear from and what connections do we have in the community, and is there someone else that's going to be a better choice, whether by connection or experience or preparation? Because community focus groups are not interrogations. We've heard bad stories from a facilitator once who took away kind of the wrong messages and did this very weird, again, kind of almost interrogation about specific events that had happened to women. And really, it's not about kind of laying out all of the details if I've been raped or if I'm being beaten. It's wanting to learn about my insight into how can community systems be helpful or not. And as a facilitator, it's also not about you, so it's not an opportunity to really divert attention to your opinions as a facilitator, but really to maximize that learning and a conversation with, not talking to, the group that's assembled around the table, but really respecting their insight and expertise as co-investigators, as teachers about the particular question or issue that you're exploring. So setting a framework of respect is critical. Addressing confidentiality, as Alex mentioned previously, and one of the tools that you'll see in this collection that's on the website is a sample consent form that kind of explains what this involves and what will be explored and any possible risks for participation. And then setting a framework right up front that what we talk about in the discussion stays in the discussion. And being really clear that any participant has the full right to leave if she wants to say as little or as much about her own experience, and taking time up front to establish a respect and a connection and a tone that really is clear about the purpose and how the information will be used. Alex had mentioned being prepared for anything, and I would second that completely. Be prepared for way more people than you expected. Sometimes be prepared for maybe way fewer, and thinking about then having it becomes a kind of a different dynamic. If for some reason you thought seven were coming and for whatever reasons only two show up, perhaps thinking about offering, would they want to keep going with the discussion? Would they want to do maybe an interview by phone at a later time? I've had a couple of experiences like that, and truly people are very generous and usually want to, while there, have the opportunity to talk. But then you can go into a different kind of depth if you have only two or three people than if you all of a sudden have 30 and needed to kind of figure out how to divide up and manage and facilitate that process. I'm thinking, too, of one, this kind of looking ahead to where you're doing this in the facility, and this was a focus group with women, I think all who had very young children, and it was arranged, sort of the space was arranged by someone else, and it turned out to be a concrete floor with no childcare. And it meant that almost all of us were at different points kind of trying to serve as bumpers for the toddlers that were wandering around on a concrete floor and sometimes falling. It was a little challenging. So that being flexible, being prepared for anything, although those kind of advanced planning points that Alex was making really help minimize big surprises. So that kind of getting a sense of who's coming and from where and what is the space like and how will the food get there and what do we need to set up for compensation. And again, we've got a number of tools on the website that provide different checklists and guides to putting this together. So getting everyone around the table, this is different than particularly in doing focus group discussions with survivors and women who have maybe very used to a support group kind of setting. Part of what you'll be doing if you're the facilitator or if you're preparing a facilitator is upfront making clear that you might have to interrupt. We're here to kind of focus on insights around a particular question. It's different from a support group. And emphasizing that there are no right or wrong answers, really welcoming people to be candid, to disagree, to have insights that may be negative or positive about whatever we're looking at, and then clearly kind of setting up these ground rules related to what's said in the focus group stays there, the comments are confidential, free to use a different name if you like, and explaining how information is going to be used. You would never, ever, ever take what comes from a focus group and turn it around and share it in any way with people's names attached. I would also encourage paying very careful attention to how information is reported back. usually it's very helpful to have some quotes and illustrations that reinforce key themes, but at the same time being sensitive to, is this something by the very description of an event might identify someone? So that kind of care in thinking about how that information will be reported out. And explaining how the note-taking is going to proceed. Sometimes you might perhaps record the focus group and later transcribe it, as Alex noted. That requires a certain level of resources. Obviously, then someone has to listen to it and transcribe it. I've had pretty good luck in, if you have somebody who's pretty quick and skilled with a keyboard, they can just kind of sit off to one side with a laptop and with some kind of prep ahead of time, be able to follow the conversation almost in a way that produces something almost like a transcript. So that kind of thinking about how the notes get put together is one of the organizing steps that carries over into how we conduct the focus group.
Something that we've done a few times also is, if the resources are available, the person that's taking the notes, if we have a projector, to use PowerPoint, then they can type the notes up so the participants can see as you're going along. And then later they can say, oh, actually, I didn't mean that, or, you got
right.
that a little wrong.
So, oh, that's a great idea. And that kind of flexibility and maybe also then having a flip chart available, perhaps you get to talking and it would be helpful to kind of draw an illustration of something, how a different process works or the different pathways by which someone's coming in to some kind of advocacy or service or system. You can do little surveys, folks raising hands. You might also think about using scenarios to respond to, particularly thinking about introducing discussions related to intimate partner violence and sexual violence and wanting to hear very broadly from community members, but not necessarily not wanting to put people in a position that compromises their safety or requires any kind of raising of a hand to say, oh, this has happened to me. But a scenario can be a way to draw on personal experience and then speak from that experience or from what you know about what your sister, mother, girlfriend, or cousin has gone through, and be able to draw out an understanding of how advocacy is working or how the police response is working, whatever you're particularly wanting to find out about. And again, this is another tool that we have on the website that illustrates ways in which scenarios can be used. And some of the other things that you'll find there, too, are examples of questions. And what you'll see is not a lot of questions, but some kind of key areas that, as organizers and as facilitators, we want to learn about, but not in a kind of laundry list of here's 10 or 20 different things we want to find out and by goodness, we're going to ask each one of these. That's a different kind of discussion and a different kind of interview. So, for example, there's an illustration on the website about guiding questions and kind of a set of cues for a facilitator related to a safety and accountability audit that's looking at 911 and a police response. And you'll see there are four key questions with some follow-up points in between. But I'm going to back up a bit. Part of the getting started is setting a tone with a general kind of question that everyone can answer, that everyone might will feel comfortable with, kind of get used to the sound of their voice, and that could be a kind of icebreaker thing about, you know, do you prefer dark chocolate or milk chocolate? Kind of easing into questions that get more in more detail and might be more challenging in the discussion. So, for example, in this case, the example is starting out after the introduction, how many of you have had contact with 911 because your partner was scaring or hurting you? And that's a survey kind of question. Then you can begin to follow what happened with those who had contact, and then also find out what happened if you didn't or you really tried to stay away from getting involved in that system. Alex, any thoughts or comments on questions and the kind of sequencing of questions, number of questions?
I think it is important to start with something that everybody can to answer or speak to. And so if that's just a general kind of question about chocolate or whatever, but then you can also go into relating to your overall kind of audit question. So I like to start with something everyone can answer from kind of a right now present thing, and then go back to the last question, kind of looking forward. So it's a progression from kind of a past, a present, and then a future. So the future would be their recommendation. So I always say, in a society where, you know, things would go a certain way, you know, every way that you wanted it to go, what would it look like?
Right, and I think sometimes that question, too, is often a place where if someone's been a more quiet or shy or reluctant to jump in, there's that opportunity to hear from everyone. And that kind of future question, what would it look like, should we be looking for, listening for, asking about, can really help to draw in. The other point that I would offer, too, is really pay attention once the focus group has officially concluded, because more than once, the really valuable teaching has come in that discussion as everyone's kind of relaxed, and maybe the tape recorder's off or the note taker's packing up, and then there's this conversation about a really important issue or aspect of experience that becomes almost as valuable as anything that formally came up.
Interesting.
I think another thing, too, is that you just kind of reminded me of something a minute ago, and that is that, you know, people have natural conversation patterns that they're comfortable in their own kind of family or their own community. And so the way that the focus group is structured is really important to think about that. So, like, in a lot of Native American communities, for example, people use the talking circle method because people are generally more comfortable talking and then silence, listening, and then the next person talks, and that's kind of how conversations go. In other communities or families, people will kind of finish sentences for each other. And so if you have a group, a mix of people, as facilitator, you have to kind of be aware of that and make sure that those that come from a culture where it takes you think about what you're going to say or you're used to a lot of silence, they may not have a chance to jump in, or they may not feel comfortable jumping in or saying, I have something to say. So to make sure that each person has equal opportunity to say something is important.
Thank you, Jane and Alex. Let's just stop here for a second and see if anyone has any questions. That would be number one on your keypad if you wanted to connect into the call. Just give it a second here, and then we'll move on to how to use this information from focus groups, how to translate what you've heard.
And I'll emphasize that, again, that there are a lot of tools available through the website. They might even seem a little overwhelming right now if anyone has them up in front. And these are the kinds of questions that we can also kind of help problem solve and talk about with communities as they're trying to set things up.
Yeah. There's a lot to learn about focus groups. So, Alex, why don't we move on then to different ways that people can use this information? What do you do with this information?
Okay, great. So now that you've conducted your focus group or your focus groups, you'll have all of this information, and the information will take the form of, tapes or PowerPoint slides or notes or flip charts, paper. And so after every focus group, it's a really good idea to have some members of the team there to do a debriefing. A debriefing about how things went, but also, to think about some themes that have kind of popped out. So some kind of understanding of the notes. It's just not looking at the details of the notes, but pulling out some of the gaps that are starting to appear. And so that information that you have will now become text that you're going to analyze. And so we've done, you've all been trained on different kinds of text analysis. And so with the focus group notes or flip charts, as a team, you can start to look at any kind of gaps that are appearing. And so when we say gaps, we're looking at disjunctures between the people's experiences and what the institutional response was. And very often these gaps will link to systemic forms of oppression that are happening. So, racism, sexism, homophobia, and then again linking to how we can better, how the system can enhance or how it's creating barriers. So the information that you get, you can be used to shape and refine your assessment question. So if you're starting with a focus group in the beginning of your assessment, then after that, then you can take your information and say, okay, what are some things that are coming out that we haven't even thought about, or things that maybe we all have thought about, but it's just never been explored, and we need to, want to make systemic change somewhere down the road. It's also a way to check findings that you've already gathered from your information, or check assumptions that you might have about work practices and about how systems work. It's also a way to clarify how different people experience practices or interventions as helpful or not. And it's important to think about that helpful part as well, because often we focus on what's not working, but sometimes it's key to look at what is working and why it's working, and, those things that are helping or enhancing. If you look at some of the examples on the links, there's focus group summary example 1 and focus group summary example 2. And so those are examples of notes that have been taken from focus groups and then put into points that kind of summarize places where gaps are happening, places where there's a disjuncture between institutional response and what people actually needed or wanted. So it doesn't have to be extensive verbatim summaries of what happened in a focus group, but rather kind of thinking about the overall picture and drawing out key themes that have emerged. I'm not sure if there's anything else that you want to add to that, Jane.
Well, you know, we have the examples there. You know, it's interesting. There's something that's just come to mind, and I'd like to check this with you, Alex. And I'm thinking of some of the focus groups that I've been involved in. And sometimes I think what you're hearing, you just have to kind of stop the process and the note-taking. I'm thinking of one where a woman started talking about her child being murdered by her former partner. And sometimes that happens, and I think we have to be kind of prepared then to acknowledge and just stop and comfort and that. And it, I think it kind of connects with using the information because it's such a powerful speaking to someone's experience and this window into where and how different systems had not worked as they had intended to. And that kind of connection then that is made between someone teaching us and learning very difficult things.
Well, and that brings up for me, too, I mean, about debriefing of the team or the focus group facilitators, but do you recommend a debriefing of the participants, or how do you handle that?
Well, Alex mentioned earlier, and I think this is really important in talking with survivors, is having someone there who can kind of make the connection and having time to kind of check in afterwards, and it's not this you end and then everyone out the door. Now, everyone may want to go out the door and need to, but to have that space and tone and environment that you can talk a little longer and you can say, are you okay? You know, Susan's here. She can talk with you. So that there's not a just taking from at all, but there's
so
an acknowledgement.
That would not be the facilitator or a member of the team.
Well, you know, in some communities it could be.
Yeah, sometimes it is because, you know, people wear different hats and play different roles in the community.
So I think as much kind of thinking about how to use what our roles are and where we come in and having that kind of support available if we're doing focus group with survivors. You know, and another thing, too, in terms of using information is kind of building in a way so that participants can get that back. You know, they can see the notes or they can see ultimately the report or the actions that were taken or how this helped then influence change. So on the, I think without having it open, on the consent form, for example, there's an example there where at the bottom there's a tear-off. You know, would you like a copy of the notes or would you like to get a copy of the final recommendations that come from this project? You know, provide an address where we're likely, where it's likely to reach you in maybe another 6 months, whatever that time frame is. And then as Alex was pointing out, that option of maybe doing the notes up on a set of slides where at the end you could kind of reflect back on them and see if that's accurate and what those themes might be.
So the other thing I'm wondering about when you talk about kind of discovering these gaps, is that a process that then your assessment group, whomever that is, would be brought in? Do you think that there's benefit in having members of that assessment group observing a focus group?
I think it's, sometimes it's a really good idea, and I'll give you an example of one of the one project that I was observing. It was to look at gaps in the medical industry or medical services, gaps towards Aboriginal clients. And somebody told a story in one of the first focus groups and people, you know, in the group heard it. And then when I went to the next focus group to observe, I noticed that that story had become part of the narrative of that small community.
Oh.
And then in the third focus group, it had become almost like an urban like an urban myth, kind of, because if you think about that telephone game where someone says something, there were kernels of that story, but now it had been an experience that everyone had or a number of people in the community had, even though it was a very specific to one story. So it's a way to kind of see the bigger picture, but also a way to start doing some analysis also. And, you know, everyone has their own style of facilitating, so if you observe different people, you can pick and choose or see what may work for you as a facilitator.
Exactly. Many different styles. But
And then thinking about, you know, who might be a good fit for observing, you know, that takes some thoughtfulness, and you don't want a lot of people necessarily getting in this sort of fishbowl experience. So maybe it's one person in addition to the facilitator and note taker at this focus group, and maybe at a different one it's another team member if you have that kind of project going on.
Okay. Well, we have just a couple minutes left, and certainly if anyone has a question, now is the time. But as Jane said, this is something that the Praxis staff can work with folks on as you work through your projects. But Jane, did you just want to run through briefly, you've talked a lot about the logistics guide, just a couple minutes of what else might be in there that folks should look for?
I will do that, and also kind of invite if there are any last minute questions to press one. There's a couple of things, well, there's more than a couple of things in there for anyone who has had a chance to scroll through there, but it's a package of tools that for those who are doing community assessment, it ties into some familiar themes and materials from the Safety and Accountability Audit Toolkit. There's a couple of the kind of foundation graphics related to the complexity of risk and safety. Beyond that, there's some broader materials related to the issues of addressing unintended consequences and disparity. There's material by Radia Jabbar and Shamita Das Gupta on assessing social risks of battered women, kind of connecting back with that need to talk and read and listen and learn to be able to ultimately begin to better address questions related to disparity of impact and bad consequences that we don't intend. So that's there. There's a culture handbook by Sujata Warrior and Marissa Dadagachan and others. And there's a link to that kind of material. And then there's a bunch of stuff related to organizing, conducting, and planning focus groups. Kind of overview, planning checklist, how specifically you might use them in a community assessment, safety audit type of project, different examples of ideas for flyers, facilitator cues, examples of questions. There's material there on using scenarios, sample consent form, and then examples of summarizing this in a way that can be carried, for example, to a larger team or community group that's working on an issue, as well as some specific reports that are grounded very much in focus group work, including the Native Women's Research Study that Alex was involved in and referred to. There's another example there related to using focus groups to explore Native women's with sexual assault and intervention by community legal systems. there's an example related to supervised visitation. And so there's a lot of food for thought, as well as some specific tools to use in thinking about using this particular approach as a way of expanding our knowledge and in beginning to understand and address how different systems and practices have a very different effect on people depending on where what our lived experience and standpoint is.
And it sounds like it's worth spending some time on. Thank you. Thank you, Jane, and thank you, Alex. It's been very, very interesting. I think we could go for another hour or so. there's two things that we want to do before we close today, and the first is to let you know that we are going to forward an evaluation of the session, so your feedback is just so important as we think about topics and different training work. So we appreciate your feedback, and please look for that email. We also want to just quickly let you know that there's several other training opportunities happening in the next couple of months. Denise, what is Praxis doing? Do you want to share that with us?
Yes, thank you, Lucy. Just to let people know, we have some other calls, audio conference training calls, like we just have finished today. The next one is going to be coming up on June 21st. And that is on collecting data, interviews, observations, and analyzing case files. It will be at the same time, 2 o'clock Central Time. In addition, some of you may know about the Praxis best practice self-assessment tools that we have developed from the safety and accountability audit that has been work that's been done around the country. And we've been teaching those in a series of webinars. And we have the next webinar coming up. It'll be the second webinar in a 3-part series on how to use these best practice self-assessments. And we will be holding a webinar again at 2 o'clock Central on Wednesday, May 9th. And that will be specifically about taking people through a text analysis process of analyzing case files specifically related to 911 and police reports. And then finally, we have a series of just networking calls where people can call in and talk about whatever topics are of interest to them. So it's those are your calls for you to tell us what you'd like to talk about. And those calls take place on the fourth Wednesday of each month. And then there's one final piece of technical assistance that Praxis can offer, and that is that while I think these training sessions and networking calls are so important and so helpful to many communities, we can also offer you individual technical assistance. And so if anyone just wants to talk to someone about your community assessment or audit project, if you're contemplating taking up this kind of work in your community but you have some questions, you can call me at Praxis or email me at denise@praxisinternational.org, and we'll arrange a phone call.
Thank you. And if folks want to register, then all of this information is on your website.
It is. It's all available on the Praxis website, including a link for registration.
Thank you all so much for participating, and I hope that it's been helpful. I've certainly learned a lot, and I thank you all for being here. We'll hope to see you next on May 9th, I guess, with a webinar. Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy, and I apologize for disconnections and a bad line. I will call AT&T.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Alex.
Bye-bye.